Hello, welcome to Literally from the North Shore, and thanks for tuning in. Today we continue with KTWH volunteer Beth Alexander's reading of Minnesota author Dennis Hirschbach's book, A River Through Two Harbors. This book chronicles fictional North Shore law enforcement officer Deidre Johnson, who uncovers a crime ring that is trafficking Native girls to the harbor in Duluth. This book contains mature themes and may not be appropriate for all listeners. We pick up where Beth left off last time.
For what seemed a very long time, they stared at the pubescent body. The girl was young enough that her breasts appeared to not be fully developed, and her nipples were still forming. Deidre surmised her age to be only about 13 or 14, perhaps only 12, because her pubic area was so sparsely covered with fine black hair. "What kind of animal did this?" Melissa mumbled, not expecting an answer. Deidre shook her head. Judy gently separated the legs of the corpse and moved so she could have a better view. She turned on a small tape recorder and began speaking. "The subject has severe bruising on the inside of the thighs." Deidre assumed she had already recorded what had been discovered on the rest of the body. "I am now spreading the labia majora. There appears to be bruising consistent with being roughly manipulated. Several tears are evident in the tissue, and the labia minora are similarly traumatized." She turned off the tape recorder and reached for her camera. After taking several close-up photos, Judy turned to Melissa and Deidre. "There's no doubt this girl was sexually active. From the bruising, I'm almost positive it wasn't consensual. That really doesn't make much difference, because at her age, it would still be considered rape." Melissa and Deidre were too stunned by what they were witnessing to say anything. Judy turned on her tape recorder and began again. "I'm inserting a speculum into the vagina of the corpse and proceeding with an internal inspection. The vaginal walls are badly bruised. A 3-centimeter hematoma is visible on the posterior vaginal wall, consistent with blunt force trauma from a foreign object. The cervix is badly bruised, showing lacerations around its circumference." She turned off the recorder and took several vaginal swabs with what appeared to Deidre to be oversized Q-tips. Using a camera designed to take internal pictures, Judy snapped several shots of what she had observed, removed her tools of examination, and stepped back from the table as she removed her gloves. "There's no doubt in my mind but that this girl was sexually tortured, then strangled, and her apparently lifeless body thrown from the bridge onto the ice. She must have revived enough to crawl up under the abutment where she died and subsequently became partially frozen. Judging by the time you found her, Deidre, and by the partially frozen condition, she died about 4 o'clock yesterday morning. I'll do more research concerning the temperature night before last, but that is my guess right now. Do you have any questions or observations? Otherwise, I'll put her back into the cooler." Deidre had enough sense about her to ask, "Have you taken fingerprints? And how about DNA samples?" "The prints are over there," she motioned toward the counter. "Her blood samples are in vials in the refrigerator. The swabs I just took are in case the perpetrator left some of his semen in her. There were no samples of skin under her nails. I was hoping she'd put up a fight and scratched whoever did this, but it appears she was so overpowered she had no chance." After a moment, Judy said, "This is one case I want to see solved. Someone has to pay for this atrocity." She took a moment to compose herself before continuing. "Preliminarily, I think she may be a little older than what she looks, but only by 2 or 3 years. Her third molars, what are commonly called wisdom teeth, haven't begun to erupt, but her second molars are completely emerged. That usually occurs when a child is between 12 and 13 years of age. In this case, there is some evidence, chips and signs of wear, that would indicate to me she may be 15 or 16. I'll know better when I can do a more thorough exam in my lab." "Is there anything else you can tell us?" Deidre questioned, pain evident by her facial expression. "It's far too soon to tell, but just between the three of us, I believe this girl is Native American. She has the characteristic high cheekbones and other facial bone structures. Also, and it's difficult to tell because of her bruising and having been frozen, but her skin has the coloring of that ethnic group. When we do the blood work, we can tell a little more. If she is type O, that would support my theory but not prove it. 80% of indigenous people have that type. A significant number, 15%, are type A. That is also a factor to consider. but only 4% are type B, and less than 1% are type AB. If she turns out to be either of those, odds are she is not Native American. Deidre mulled the figures for a second. Well, that would be a starting point, I suppose. Melissa had been strangely silent through the entire examination of the body, and all she did was nod. Judy respectfully replaced the drape over the body and wheeled it back into the cooler. None of the women wanted to go to lunch, their appetite killed by what they had just witnessed. It was as though their senses were numbed. "Is there anywhere we can meet and discuss what we've just seen, where we can lay out a plan of attack? I think we all need to talk about this and get it out of our system. I'm talking about a plan of action, but also about the fact that we need a catharsis," Judy stated. Her posture showed how emotionally drained she was. "Deidre, is there a place where we can be alone, where we can talk openly and let out our feelings in private?" Deidre was flummoxed by the question. She thought, "We need a place where we can't be overheard and where we won't be interrupted. But we need somewhere that's comfortable, where we can feel at ease about sharing our feelings." She remembered a case 4 years earlier when she had visited with a pastor in town. She had met with him and his wife in his study. "I think I know where we want to be," she said as she reached for her cell phone and punched in a number. She listened to it ring until a man answered. "Hello, this is Reverend Jackson speaking. Can I help you?"
"Pastor, this is Deidre Johnson. How are you?"
"Deidre, I was just thinking of calling you. You know Naomi is in her third year at the U. She emailed me this morning with the news that she had been selected by Hazelden, the rehab clinic in the cities, to do her internship during spring semester. She wanted me to tell you she had lost your cell phone number." The pastor's daughter, Naomi, was instrumental in Deidre being able to break up a drug ring operating out of the Superior National Forest. While in high school, she had fallen into the lifestyle of a user, and Deidre had helped her set her life back on the right track. Now she was attending the University of Minnesota, majoring in psychology and social work with an emphasis on drug counseling.
"Great news, Pastor. I'm so happy for you and Mrs. Johnson. You have every right to be proud of her. But Pastor, I need a favor. Two friends and I need a quiet place where we can have a very private meeting, someplace comfortable. Your office immediately came to mind. Is there any chance we can use it for a couple of hours this afternoon?"
Reverend Jackson's answer was immediate. "No problem. I'm making hospital visits in an hour, and my wife's volunteering at the nursing home. Come over right away so we can visit a few minutes. It's been a while since we've seen each other. You can have the run of our home. No need to cram into my office. Use the living room." Deidre remembered how comfortable and inviting their home was. "Perfect. See you in about 15 minutes.
Chapter 5. The Jacksons' home had a feeling of order and well-being. After what the women had just observed, they needed a place where they could find a modicum of peace. Pastor Jackson hugged Deidre, who introduced him to Melissa and Judy. But after a few minutes of small talk, he had to leave to make his rounds. In the living room, they found a pot of hot coffee and a plate of cheese, crackers, and other snacks waiting for them. Deidre thought how lucky Naomi was to have parents who were so terrific. Her mind returned to the day she had brought their daughter, Naomi, home after catching her using cocaine. She remembered how supportive her parents had been. She also remembered the boy they had caught with Naomi that day, Gerald Coulter III, and how violently his father had reacted. She wondered what had happened to that young man. The three of them plopped down into the living room chairs, each with a cup of coffee in their hands. Judy spoke first. "Deidre, you said you're serving in a temporary position as a Silver Bay police officer. How long before the person you are replacing returns?"
"A week from today, then I'm through. He's a good man, and I'm confident he'll do a good job.
Why do you ask?"
"Just wondering," Judy answered, still deep in thought about the body she had so recently examined. "Even though I'm not going to be on this case much longer, I'd like you to help me set up a plan of action. I wasn't prepared for anything this severe when I agreed to fill in for 6 weeks," Deidre said. "But before we begin with that, I think we should process our own feelings. I know I, for one, am so deeply upset with what we've seen, I can hardly think of anything else. I'm angry, enraged that anyone could be so cruel. It brings back feelings for the need for revenge I experienced when John was murdered, and I don't like it. Do you have the same thoughts, or am I the only one?" Judy cleared her throat, and Deidre and Melissa waited for her to say something. Seconds slowly ticked by, and finally she was able to speak. "Last night, As I watched her frozen body relax and I could see the extent of her injuries, I wept. No one should ever experience what she went through. And yes, I thought of doing the most despicable things to the person or persons who did this. Then, while I was waiting for more thawing and while I had a chance to process, I realized that an eye for an eye would accomplish nothing. In fact, it would reduce me to the level of the perpetrators. I came to the revelation that the only way to rise above his or their level is to seek justice. The revenge will come at their own hands. After another long pause, Judy continued, "When we catch the parties involved, and we will, they'll be prosecuted, and their freedom will be taken from them. Death of any kind would be too swift and complete. I think that to rot in prison for the rest of their lives would be a far more fitting punishment than even a slow death. That thought makes me more intent on doing a thorough job and catching whoever could possibly be this animalistic. That isn't the right word. Even animals behave better than this." The three women sat silently staring at the floor, studying the carpet pattern. After a minute or so had passed, Deidre raised her head. "Melissa, you haven't said a word since viewing the body. Your posture tells me there's a lot going on in your mind. Can we help with anything?" Tears rolled down Melissa's cheeks, and she dabbed at her eyes with a tissue. She tried to talk, but choked on her words. Deidre and Judy watched her swallow hard and clear her throat. "I'm not sure I can get the words out," she struggled to say. "I have a daughter, Jessica, who's 15 years old." The two other women thought they knew what was coming next, but they were completely floored by Melissa's next words. "She always was a difficult child to deal with, especially after I divorced her father. It was not an amicable settlement, and I was awarded full custody of Jessica. Her father had visitation rights, but we never saw him after the decree. That hurt her more than I can possibly imagine. As she became older, she was almost uncontrollable. Her mood swings became so erratic, I took her to a child psychologist, but she balked at the idea every step of the way, and in the end, refused to cooperate. When she was 11, she ran away from home, and it took me 4 days to locate her. She was staying at a friend's house in one of the suburbs. Her friend's 16-year-old sister had been left in charge while their parents were on vacation. 6 months later, we had words when she refused to see her therapist, and she ran away again. That time it took us a week to track her down. Once again, she had moved in with a friend whose parents had little interest in what was going on in their child's life. Melissa blew her nose and tried to continue. Deidre sensed that there was more to the story. Over the next 2 years, Jessica's behavior became a pattern of running away, followed by bouts of contrition and then depression. Still, she resisted treatment of any kind. Her psychologist recommended we take her to a psychiatrist so we could get a handle on her depression, but she refused to cooperate, said she wasn't nuts. 2 years ago, when she was 13, she ran away for a final time. As hard as we have tried, we haven't been able to find her. Every time I think of her, I have this image in my mind of her being on the streets alone, and inside, I die. Melissa's face cracked into a contorted grimace somewhere between a failed attempt to choke back her tears and the desire to openly weep. Stunned, Deidre and Judy stared at her. Then Deidre got out of her chair, knelt beside her friend and colleague, and placed her hand on Melissa's knee. Looking into her red-rimmed eyes, Deidre said, "I can't imagine the pain this has caused you, but you still have hope. We're here for you when you need us. Always remember that." "Thanks. I know you are. I appreciate your kindness, but this case is really disturbing me, more than can possibly be imagined. I'm afraid I'll have a difficult time retaining any sense of objectivity." After several minutes of silent contemplation, Melissa stood. "Excuse me a few minutes. There's something I've decided to do." She walked out of the room, and Deidre and Judy were left to discuss how they could help their friend, who they thought had gone to the bathroom to splash cold water on her face. Time dragged, and Melissa was gone almost 20 minutes. She was more in charge of her emotions when she returned to them. "I've just gotten off the phone with the director of the BCA, my immediate boss. I told her what we've discovered and also told her about my dilemma, my feelings. I told her I was struggling with this case." "Did she have any suggestions?" Deidre wanted to know. "At first, she just listened to my story. Then we talked about what can be done. I told her you'd be finished with your assignment as of next week, Deidre, and I suggested you be hired by the BCA. It'd be on an as-needed basis, specifically to continue investigating what we have found. I explained your role in the Seven Graves case and gave you my highest recommendation. Deirdre was shocked. I don't know what to say. Maybe I should ask what her reaction was. She remembered you from when you, Judy, and I worked together. Melissa sort of laughed. She remembered that you were the one who gave most of the interviews from the burial sites in the woods. In fact, she asked if you were the one who looked so earthy. In spite of the gravity of the situation, Deirdre had to smile at that comment. I know I said I could leave the case, she told her friends, but after seeing what we saw today, there is no way I can walk away from this horrendous murder. I wouldn't be able to sleep at night, wondering what was happening. Okay, I'm in. I think this is for the best. You know this area better than anyone from the cities. You know the people, and you're very good at what you do. Thanks for being willing to continue. The BCA will notify the county sheriff what your role will be. Do you think he'll be all right with us taking most of the responsibility on this one? Do you know him? We're very close friends. You know him too. Remember Jeff? Jeff D'Angelo, my deputy, who was on the dig with us when we unearthed those seven graves? He was talked into running for sheriff after I resigned and won hands down. I can't think of anyone I'd rather have by my side than Jeff. He'll be fine with the idea of my working the case. I know he will. Judy spoke up. I have a little more work to do, collecting samples, taking a few more photos, and giving the body one more examination for anything I may have missed. I've arranged for transport to my lab at the Bureau, where I can do a more thorough job. Deirdre, I'll have the report to you first thing next week, although the tax screen will take a little longer. For now, why don't you and Melissa spend some time together while I finish up? It's a long ride back to Minneapolis, but if we can get out of Two Harbors by 5 o'clock, we can make it home by 8:30 or 9 tonight. With that, Deirdre and Melissa decided to go to a local restaurant, Blackwoods Bar and Grill. The place had spacious booths that afforded privacy. They could drink coffee and talk while Judy went about her grisly business. Chapter 6. Deirdre lay on the floor, her back propped against three large cushions. The cabin was cozy, and a fire in the wood-burning stove shone through its glass windows. Her dog, Pete, was curled up, just near enough so she could scratch his ears. Whenever she stopped, he would raise his head and thrust his nose under her hand, forcing her to resume stroking him. Deirdre was so absorbed in her thoughts she was nearly oblivious to her pet's presence. She had bitten off a huge chunk of responsibility this afternoon. She knew that, but she also knew she would never have been able to walk away from the murder she had discovered the day before. "Well, old boy, here we go again," she mused to Pete. His reaction was to roll his eyes upward and look lovingly at her. "What's it like living in a world where you get fed every day, get to sleep anytime you want, and don't have a care in the world? Or if you do, you don't seem to remember." Pete reacted by rolling on his back so she could scratch under his front legs. Deirdre looked at the clock on the mantel behind the stove. 7 o'clock. Ben would be home. She punched in his number on her cell phone. She was relieved to hear his voice. "Hi, Deirdre. When I didn't hear from you today, I thought you must really be slammed at work. How's it going?" "Too long of a story to talk about on the phone, but I've got an awful lot to tell you. Any chance we can get together tomorrow? I miss the girls, and I'd like to bounce some thoughts off you, if you don't mind being my sounding board." She could hear Ben reprimand one of his daughters, and she smiled at the image in her mind. "Sorry about that. What do you have in mind, my place or yours?" "How about yours? I'd like to get out of the woods for a day or two. Maybe it'll give me some perspective, give my mind a chance to clear itself. Tomorrow's Friday. I have a few things to clear up in the morning, but I can be in Duluth by about 5. That okay?" "That's great. Can't wait to see you, and neither can the twins. They've been standing here the whole time, and you can probably hear their ruckus right now." Deirdre hung up the phone and let pleasant thoughts of Ben and his twin daughters wash over her tired mind. Tomorrow would be a better day. She woke at 6 the next morning, not well rested after having gone through a series of nightmares. After eating a hurried breakfast of yogurt sprinkled with granola and a steaming cup of coffee, she kenneled Pete in the back of her SUV and drove to work. In 5 days, Dan Butler would be back on duty, and Deirdre would be working for the BCA. By that time, Dr. Koster would have a report ready, and she would have a better idea where to begin. Until then, Deirdre was going to catch up on some minor paperwork and prepare the office for Dan's return. He probably would be relieved to learn that the BCA wanted to handle the case and that Deidre would be the one working the investigation. She made arrangements for the part-time officer to spell her later in the day. By noon, Deidre was ready to make the trip to Duluth, and she eagerly anticipated spending time with Ben and the twins. On the way through Two Harbors, she drove toward the courthouse, a majestic old building with a towering silver dome that stood like a beacon in the center of town. Next to it was the law enforcement center, and Deidre parked in front of it, walked up the stairs as she had done so many times when she was sheriff, and stopped at the security window. Gerardine, the dispatcher on duty, buzzed her into the outer office of the sheriff's department. "Deidre, great to see you," Sheriff D'Angelo exclaimed as he jumped up from his chair. "Man, it's been way too long. How you doing?" "Things were going great until day before yesterday. That's what I want to talk to you about, Jeff. Any chance we can visit in your office? This is kind of a touchy subject right now." "Hey, sure, no problem. Grab a cup of coffee and come in." He led the way, holding the door for his former boss. "I think I know why you're here, Deidre. We heard something real bad's happened in Silver Bay. Have a seat and tell me what's going on." Deidre sat down and took a sip of hot coffee before she began. "We had an ugly murder 3 days ago. I suppose all murders are ugly, but this one is way past ugly. A teenage girl is involved, and all I can say is you're lucky you didn't have to see it. That's why I'm here. You remember Judy, Dr. Koster, who helped us with the Seven Graves case? I called her and Melissa in on this one. Judy's finished her exam, and the body's been shipped to the BCA building in Minneapolis. We couldn't ID the body from the evidence we had." Jeff interrupted. "Of course I remember them. Now there are two competent persons. You three made quite a team." Deidre smiled. "Yeah, we're just regular three musketeers. Anyway, I wanted to give you the heads up about the investigation. The BCA's assuming jurisdiction in this case. The body was found within the city limits of Silver Bay, but their force has such limited resources, there's no way they can lead the charge. Because of my knowledge of the area, I've been hired by the BCA to handle the investigation of this murder. Jeff, I told them I didn't think that'd be a problem between us. I hope I was right." Jeff leaned back in his chair and steepled his fingertips. "A problem? The only problem is that you aren't sitting in this chair, and I'm not your deputy. You were the best sheriff this county ever had, and I still regret you didn't fight that bugger of an attorney, Gerald Coulter. He's still pushing his way around the courthouse, causing trouble. It seems he's always just a step from crossing the line with his tactics. Just the other day, we thought we had him for witness tampering. Then, on the stand, the witness reversed her testimony, saying she had misunderstood what Mr. Coulter had said to her. She recanted the statement she had made to us. But enough of that garbage. Deidre, it's good to have you back on our team. Just tell me what I can do to help." Deidre felt one burden she had been carrying lift. "I thought you'd feel that way, but I couldn't be sure. Thanks, Jeff, for your vote of confidence. I promise I'll keep you in the loop, but right now I've got to get to Duluth. Ben's little girls are waiting for me." "And how about Ben?" Jeff asked, a knowing smile on his face. Deidre felt her face flush, and she so wished she could control that reaction which had plagued her since childhood. "Come on, Jeff, you know better than that. We're just good friends." All Jeff did was smile and nod. Deidre knocked on the door, but didn't wait for Ben to answer. She hardly had time to step through the doorway when 2 4-year-olds jumped into her arms. "Are you going to stay here tonight, Deidre?" they questioned in unison. Before she could answer, Megan asked, "Did you bring Pete with you?" "Yes and yes." She scooped up the girls, one in each arm, and started for the living room while Ben stood back, a broad grin on his face. "It's good to see you so chipper," he said. "The girls were awfully disappointed when you couldn't make it the other night. It's great you're here for them." He left the room for the kitchen, where he had mac and cheese on the stove for supper. "You know I'm not much of a cook, but we try," he hollered from the other room. Deidre could hear him placing silverware and plates on the table. The sound of milk being poured into glasses followed, and then the familiar call, "Come and get it." The twins jumped off Deidre's lap and pulled her by her hands into the dining room. "I get to sit by Deidre," Marin called dibs. "You don't have to worry. I'll bet Dad set the table so one of you can sit on each side of me during dinner," she reassured them. The meal was accompanied by laughter and funny faces, and Megan and Marin clung to Deidre the entire time. Dessert was gingerbread men that Ben had bought at a local bakery. The girls played with them, pretending that they could run as they recited, "Run, run as fast as you can. You can't catch me. I'm the gingerbread man." Then they would pretend they were the fox in the nursery rhyme and bite a part of him off. The game continued until there was nothing left of their gingerbread men. Deirdre looked at them with so much love and caring that her eyes became teary. "What's the matter, Deirdre?" Megan asked, looking confused. "Are you sad?" She hugged them close. "No, I'm so happy. I can't keep it all inside me," she said. Ben coughed and began clearing the table. The four of them played games until 8 o'clock. "Okay, you little imps, time for bed." "I'm not an imp," Marin declared, her hands on her hips. "Oh, yes, you are," Ben exclaimed as he swept her up and started up the stairs. Deirdre followed behind with Megan. "Will you tuck us in, Deirdre?" they asked in unison. Deirdre drew the covers up to their chins, brushed the hair back from their faces with her hand, and kissed each girl on her forehead. "Sleep tight, my little one," she said. Megan spoke up. "Daddy always says, and don't let the bedbugs bite," and she giggled as she wriggled deeper under the down quilt. Ben flicked off the light switch, and the room took on a warm glow from their Cinderella nightlight that shone dimly from the wall outlet in the corner of the room. "Good night, my little ones," he said, as he partially closed their bedroom door. Deirdre was glad the girls had been put to bed so early. She needed time to talk out yesterday's events with Ben, and as they sat on opposite ends of the couch, she told him about the BCA's offer to have her join their force, if only for this one case. He agreed that she was the right person for the job, and he wished her well. The rest of the time they talked about Megan and Marin. It was evident they were two loved little girls, and Ben let Deirdre know how much they loved her. For an instant, Deirdre wished Ben would move closer to her, but she forced that thought from her mind. She was here because of two little girls who had no mother, plain and simple. Anything else would complicate the matter and possibly destroy a good thing. The two adults talked until midnight. Finally, Ben announced, "I think we'd better get some sleep. The twins will be awake and raring to go by 7 o'clock. Be ready for them to come wake you. I told them they could." Deirdre made her way to the spare bedroom upstairs and readied herself for bed. She could hear Ben rummaging in the room down the hall, and then the house was quiet. She slept well that night, knowing tomorrow would be filled with the antics of two needy little girls. She was still sleeping when Megan and Marin barged into her room and jumped onto her bed. "Deirdre, you're still here," they cried out in delight. "Daddy said we could wake you up, and so we did. Is that okay, Deirdre? Is it?" Deirdre rolled onto her back and forced her eyes open. Then she grabbed the two tykes and pulled them close to her. "Of course it's okay. I have waited all week to do this," and she kissed each one of them on the cheek. "Just give me a chance to get the sleepies out of my eyes."
You've been listening to episode 3 of A River Through Two Harbors by Minnesota author Dennis Hirschbach. There will be a total of 20 episodes in this reading, so be sure to tune in next time for more from A River Through Two Harbors. If you miss an episode, you can find it on our website, ktwh.org, by clicking on Programs and then Literally from the North Shore on the drop-down list. Each weekend, we'll post the episodes for you to catch up on. To learn more about human trafficking in Minnesota, go to www.yourcallmn.org. Please join us again next time for A River Through Two Harbors here on Literally from the North Shore.